Oh, good evening. Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is wonderful. We're in the middle of Record of Things Heard, Dogen's words, going very, very, very slowly. Let's do introductions around before we begin.
I'm Donna Lynn.
Angie. Pronounce your name again.
Abijah.
Abijah? I've heard it pronounced so many different ways. I just wanted to get it from the horse's mouth. My father used to call me Miss Abijah, so it's close. It's so close.
What does
that mean? I just made it up. It's when I was being good. He called me Annabelle when I was bad. So I think we're on number 12. Does somebody know for sure? Let's start at 12.
It's definitely after the cat.
It's definitely after the cat, yes. Yes, yes.
The instructor. Of old, a man known as the meditation master, Chiyo Charo, aroused his will and abandoned his home in this wise. Originally, this master was a civil profession. Endowed with intelligence and ability, he was an honest and upright wise man. When he was a provincial governor, he stole government funds and gave them away. Others reported this to the emperor.
Upon hearing this, the emperor was greatly astonished, and all of his ministers thought it strange. The crime was not a minor one, and it was decided that capital punishment should be administered.
At this point, the emperor discussed the matter, saying, "This minister is a man of talent, a wise and good man. Now he has purposely committed this crime. Could it be that he has some deep motive? When you are about to behead him, if he shows any sign of grief or distress, behead him immediately. If he shows no such signs, then he must certainly have some deep intent and you should not behead him." He's worse than the cat.
I got it. When the imperial emissary brought him out to be beheaded, he showed no signs of distress. Rather, his appearance was one of joy. He himself said, "I give this life to all sentient beings."
The emissary, surprised and struck with wonder, reported this to the emperor. The emperor said, "It is so. He certainly has some profound intent. I knew it had to be so. Therefore, he asked what his intention was."
The master said, "To leave public office, give up my life, practice charity, form a bond with all creatures, be born in a Buddhist family, and single-mindedly practice the Buddhist way."
The emperor was moved by this and allowed him to leave home, Therefore, he bestowed on him the name Yen Shu, prolonging life, because he had stayed a certain execution.
Patronubed monks of today should also once arouse such a mind, with a profound heart which thinks little of your own life and has compassion for living beings. You should arouse a mind which aspires to entrust your bodily life to the Buddhist precepts. If you already have such a mind, even for a moment, you should preserve it so as to not lose it. Without once arousing such a mind, there can be no awakening of the Buddha way.
That's it. Well, what do you think? Even then they had Robin Hood. When I first read this, I wrote at the bottom, but. But that's bad. Shouldn't do that. But
a basic question about this one. Why is it that it seems that in Zen teaching, typically, if the student says A, most of the time the teacher will say not A to make sure that the student isn't stuck in A.
Yes.
And if the student said not A, the teacher would say A so the student wouldn't get stuck in not A.
Precisely.
And yet, there are times when the student says A, and especially in these stories where of enlightenment, and the teacher says, that's it. And I'm kind of wondering, what is it that, you know, in this story, I feel that we've kind of, it's more the former case, where he's saying, you know, if the guy is, what is it, stressed, and cut him off immediately, that's a version of A, and then giving him not A. That's where I read it. So how do you know when you're not supposed, I mean, you as the teacher or the one who understands that it's not A and not A and not A and A, it's just A and not A. Did I say that right?
I think I know what you mean. In this case, it's talking about the point where you're willing to throw your whole life away, to step off the 100-foot pole, and the consequences are of no account at all.
So
and
this is not logical.
It's not logical at all. It's about the point that we get to in our life when we're willing to give ourselves up in order to, for, how does he put it? Compassion for living beings, arouse a mind which aspires to entrust your bodily life to the Buddhist precepts.
That's not, there's no logic in that at all.
No, none.
None.
It's way beyond logic. So it is like the cat in that sense. And it's also about being willing to break all the rules.
Can I ask a follow-on?
Yes, I can hear it.
But I feel that there is room for illogical and human lessons in Zazen and in practice. And yet there are times when the reasoning is perfectly logical.
And yes.
You read many stories about people seeing it like an argument given to them, and they say, oh yes. Yeah, admittedly, there are many cases where it's illogical, but just because something's illogical doesn't mean it is an enlightened statement or an enlightened expression, is it?
No, not necessarily. Often when somebody pronounces A and somebody else pronounces B, brings up the other side. That in itself is an insightful moment for both of them. And that's why it works that way, because there isn't any one point. There's always at least one other point. So a big part of the so-called teaching is just always bringing up the other side. so that both sides can be experienced by both of the people in the conversation. And even then, there's always more. But
it seems like whenever I hear the koans or these stories, that it's always looked at as what the koan of the story is, an enlightened state. And I think I felt it misses the point that it's an enlightened statement. There's no such thing. It's the one who hears a statement that seems enlightened, or one who becomes enlightened from something that contradicts their own concept, that ends up making that happen.
Because it breaks up the ideas, the fixed ideas.
Why do you think, or what would you say about one thing here, whenever I hear selflessness, or in a sense, not caring about your own life and just being compassionate towards others, it almost reminds me of times when people say, just let the universe take care of it, you know, or the universe is going to take care of it. And there's this idea of oneness that, you know, the universe is constantly taking care of everything. But then it's so easy for a human being or for a person to slip in to the idea, and then they separate themselves from that universe. So the selflessness, or to not care about your own life, or to forget about yourself, if it's just an idea, it feels like these kind of stories lean into the idea of selflessness rather than the inclusiveness of, say, Abhijit and what the world is, you know, and what everything is.
Well, these were addressed to monks, already committed monks, all these little talks. So it's well to keep that always in mind. Monks who had already left home and decided to practice with Dogen. So already you have a situation. So he's kindly trying to help them see what it means to give up a life in government politics and do that kind of work. That if you're going to be a monk, that you give up everything. You end up with a bowl and a needle and enough money to bury you. That's it. And a couple of robes. So we don't have to take this literally. I hope we don't. I don't think we can. But it can help us see our own life as far as our own awakening to the Buddha way. And I think we all each have our own experience of that. And the reason we practice in the first place is and the reason we come together is because we already have insight into what that means, what that is for us, even though we might not be able to put it in words. And that it informs our life. We don't have to even talk about enlightenment. I prefer insight. I think we have so many insights and so few enlightenments that it takes the pressure off to just live life and allow it to, or allow ourselves to flow within it, or it to flow within us. Does that answer it? Julian?
So it seems that whole decision that a monk made to leave their family, to leave this idea of any, you know, of almost life, for lack of a better word, it's coming to mind at the moment.
Mm.
It's almost as if it's like a little death in a way to come to
yes.
a monastery.
Yes, it is.
Do you think these monks really reflected on that all the time?
Oh, I doubt it. Once they made that change, it's a huge change of mind. And I've often considered what that means for us as lay practicers. We can't and don't do that radical change of mind. And yet I think as we go deeper and deeper into the practice, that we can have that change of mind and maintain a life in the world. That home leaving doesn't necessarily mean, you know, closing the door on your family and leaving, but it means having a different attitude toward the whole world. Maybe you could say of service. Selfless service. But once you get in the monastery, of course, then you're living life and it becomes pretty ordinary from what I understand. I haven't done it very long, not long enough. Well, I was a month practicing with a group, and it was pretty ordinary, actually. We had some arguments and some shopping expeditions, a lot of very unmonkish things going on. Good evening. Come in.
For some reason, I began at 8.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I thought we began at 8.
Oh, sorry. No, it's 6:30. Yeah.
I apologize.
That's all right.
Historically, in the 1200s in Japan, that the monks that he's talking to, is this a time that they may enter the monastery, the shoguns have died, or the samurai, is that long before then?
It was before the samurai time. Long before.
Is it... I know, like, some of the women nuns in China, when they lost their husband,
yes,
son.
Yes.
So at this time during Dogen thing, did all these men come on their own?
Yes, there weren't...
You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, the social reasons.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There weren't any... There weren't social reasons for men. There were for women. Orphans often were taken by the women women nuns, or divorced women, or women who ran away from their husbands if they were abused. But Dogen's monks were very dedicated because he, for one, took them away into the deep mountains. So if they went with him, that was a real commitment on their part, and lifetime commitment. You know, it's cold, deep, deep snow in the winter time. It was very remote and very, very primitive then. Yeah. Do we have time to read another one? Should we do that?
In an evening talk, he said, The basis for understanding talk about Zen in the school of the patriarchs is to take the mind which thinks it already knows and revise it step by step in accordance with the words of the teacher.
Even if the manner of your original knowledge has been that you know Buddha to be Shakyamuni or Amida, etc., replete with excellent characteristics and radiant halo, possessed of the virtue of teaching Dharma and benefiting living beings, yet if the teacher should say that Buddha is a frog or a worm, you should believe that frogs and worms are Buddha, and should abandon your former understanding. If you looked for the auspicious marks and radiant halo and the various merits of a Buddha on those worms, it means that your emotional views have still not changed. It is just a matter of knowing what one sees just then as Buddha. If in this way you go on revising your emotive views and original attachments in accordance with the teacher's words, then you will naturally come to an understanding.
Pass it to Donna Lynn. Here. It's going to slip.
However, students of recent times cling to their own emotive views and base themselves on their own opinions, thinking that Buddhahood must indeed be such in such a way. If it is something different from what they themselves think, they say it can't be that way. As long as they are wandering in delusions, seeking something which resembles their own emotional judgments, most of them make no progress on the Buddha way.
Again, having climbed to the top of a 100-foot pole without sparing your bodily life, and when you are told to let go your hands and feet and advance one step further, you say that it is only when one has life that one can study the Buddha's teaching. In reality, this is not really obeying the teacher. You should consider this carefully.
I like this one a lot. Your teacher says frogs and worms are Buddha. Abandon your former understanding. I have a very nice man who helps me when my house starts breaking. And one time he watched me feeding the squirrels. I have a bird feeder and then a bunch of squirrels that run along the railing of the deck right outside my window. And he said he hated squirrels because they tried to get the bird seed and they made a mess, and he went on and on about the bad squirrels. And I said, I they're kind of neat, and they were here before we were, and so we talked about the squirrels. And I saw him the other day, and he said, you know what? I started feeding the squirrel. It's really neat. I thought, yeah.
Did you talk about gophers?
Yes. I have a friend who knocks them off one by one. I've got some stuff you can spray on the ground. You soak it in, and they don't like it. It's good stuff. And it doesn't hurt them. It just sends them somewhere else.
To your neighbors.
Well, likely, yes.
Then, stuff, huh?
Yeah. So this is, you can imagine what coming into a Buddhist context with your eyes dazzled by the golden Buddhas and the whole idea of Buddha as some fabulous being, to be told that it's worms and frogs is kind of a shock. But without that, grounding in the practice, it just becomes one more game that we play, one more hula hoop that we amuse ourselves with. We can make all kinds of elaborations on practice, make it special. But it's so special it includes even frogs and worms. That's how special it is. I don't imagine most teachers would teach it like this. But I don't know. Dogen did. Suzuki Roshi used to look around and say, Buddha, 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 Buddha. Infinite, infinite. Book floor.
I guess I kind of understand that, the whole, the everything, you know, but isn't there also, like, a danger of numbing your mind, kind of saying, Buddha, you know?
Yes, just like Abhijit was talking about, we can turn what used to be called hippie Zen, you know, where we say, oh, it's all one. So we can do anything we want. Or beatnik Zen, you know, where because everything is one, it doesn't matter anymore. So it's an idea, as it shows up here. It's also an experience. So when you read about it, if you take it up as an idea, it can be very misleading. If you understand that it's an experience, then it's expressed to us, so when we have the experience, it's confirmed for us. But it makes it, you really have to be careful with all this kind of material, because it can hold it up a big goal. You know, oh, I have to live up to this, and this is going to happen. Well, we don't know. But it confirms people's experience. And it offers us a kind of window into practice and what can happen. No promises made. But what's in us to happen. Including stepping off the 100-foot pole. And that's a point in our life, when we get to the point where we can't go anymore. There's nowhere else to go. Not even one step. And that's when you take that step.
In an evening talk, he said, the basis for understanding talk about Zen in the school of the patriarchs is to take the mind which thinks it already knows and revise it step by step in accordance with the words of the teacher.
This, for me, it feels that it can also just be looked at very literally.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's like, again, it's the relative. Mm-hmm. That's why you want a teacher. You have more of insight, and I want to have more, maybe, insight or to learn more about it. And then, at the same time, in the absolute, as the last paragraph says, it's not at all about the teacher.
Well, then you have to ask what the teacher means and what that step-by-step process is. I mean, a teacher is really the wrong word as far as some person is concerned. Each one of us is, as we say in the old cliche, we are our own teacher, or we have teaching in us that we resonate with and recognize and are confirmed by someone. That it's very hard to practice without some kind of recognition and confirmation. And so we come together with each other, and not just with a so-called teacher who sits on a brown cushion, but with each thing that you meet, actually. Each blade of grass is also a confirmation and a recognition and a transmission, as we say. You know, transmission is not some high mucky muck thing. It's that meeting that we're allowing, the menju that we were talking about, how we actually meet each thing that appears in our life. Thank you. So now it is 8 o'clock, and we'll remember next week that we're on 14. Perhaps.